You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic, yeah. It's atomic.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for the Atomic Show, number 39.
Wow. And this is Shane Brown, and as you might hear from the unfamiliarity you might have with my voice, I've been off a little bit for the last couple interviews. So it's probably time to get back into it. And we talked before about just doing kind of a grab bag. We had thought of maybe doing an interview with somebody, but they had to hold off for a bit longer. So in lieu of that...
Yeah, those part-time interview people that have to handle kids and all that stuff, you know. That's life when you're, you know, following a passion rather than simply, you know, working at this for a living.
So. Oh, sure. So
let me, I'm going to catch up some people just real quick. I think I mentioned that I had been going to the American Nuclear Society winter meeting in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which was at the very beginning of November. And while I was out there, I, for the first time, met Shane Brown. And we shared a wonderful New Mexican meal. What was the name of that restaurant, Shane?
That restaurant was Sadie's. It's in part of town called the North Valley. And there's a bunch of different New Mexican restaurants in Albuquerque, as you might imagine. One of them happens to be President Bush's favorite whenever he comes in town, but I think of it as a kind of a tourist trap. The food is rather overpriced, and you don't get very much, so I decided to go to an alternative. And you didn't get poisoned, so there you go.
Well, I'll tell you, folks, for those of you who haven't been to Albuquerque, Sadie's is definitely a place to go if you can find it. It's set off from the road a little bit. So
that's putting it mildly.
So if you're driving by, you probably won't see it.
Yeah, you have to know where you're going. But I figured I'd go there rather than take you to some gay random place right off the interstate. But yeah, it was fun getting together.
Yeah, and for those of you who have never been to New Mexico, be prepared before you go there to answer the question, red or green, when you order.
This is not a question about your holiday decoration preferences, but rather a question about what variety of New Mexican chili sauce that you want on your food. And you're going to get it. It's just a matter of asking which kind you want. Do you want the sharp hit in the face with the hammer, or do you want to be slowly beaten over the course of an hour?
Yeah, so it's not red, green, or none. It's red or green.
And then the combination is called Christmas, by the way.
Okay.
So people order burritos with Christmas, which makes for a very surreal ordering experience if you're not expecting it.
Yep. Well, the good thing is that you didn't take me to a sushi restaurant in New Mexico, and I didn't run across any polonium while I was out there.
Weird stuff, polonium. Curiously enough, in the news. So that probably leads us into the second item, which is I've been following this kind of at a distance, but I've not really paid very much attention to it because, like a lot of things that come out of Russia, unless you see them confirmed and otherwise vetted several ways by several different agencies, I tend to not really pay very close attention to them. But it sounds like this one is becoming more real by the day.
And what we're talking about is there's a man, or there was a man, I should say, who is identified as a former KGB agent who recently passed away after about a 1 month experience of having his hair fall out and his immune system crumble, and basically some of the same effects that people who have undergone chemotherapy go through, but his was fatal. What was the guy's name? I know I sent it to you, and I'm searching through.
Litvinenko.
Litvinenko. So Litvinenko was identified as a former KGB agent, and somehow, and no one's quite sure yet how, he ingested a fatal amount of the radioactive isotope polonium-210. And polonium-210 is a rather special radioisotope. It's got about 147-day half-life. That means after 147 days, half of the initial material is gone. As you might expect...
It's rather active material.
Yeah, it's pretty active, and as you might expect, there is no naturally, or very little naturally occurring polonium 210 in the world, because something with 147-day half-life would disappear pretty quickly. But there is a very tiny amount that is naturally produced by alpha and neutron reactions within naturally occurring uranium.
On the order of about a tenth of a milligram per ton.
Yeah, a tenth of a milligram per ton. So it is one of the most rare naturally occurring isotopes. But the amazing thing to me is that in the, 1898, perhaps, I can't, my system is not responding to me very quickly today, but Marie Curie was able to isolate this isotope from a large sample of pitchblende while she was doing her radium studies, and was actually the one who named polonium after her native Poland.
Yep, as a matter of fact, she also kept samples of the polonium in that she separated. I believe she actually kept samples of it around, and polonium's alpha activity is so high that it actually glows faintly blue in air.
And there are some reports that her daughter, what's Marie Curie's daughter's name?
I believe her name was Irene.
Irene Curie.
Or part of her name was Irene.
Right, Irene Curie. And Irene Curie apparently got into one of the vials at one time. And some people attribute that to Irene Curie's somewhat early death from leukemia. But I don't know about that one. That came on a PBS story.
That is a seriously highly active element. I'm looking at a description of the isotopes of polonium from a periodic table that's maintained at Los Alamos National Lab. And the amount of activity, a milligram of polonium-210 emits as many alpha particles as 5 grams of radium. Now, the thing about radium is that radium is the standard by which the Curie, which is an amount of activity of a radioactive material, is measured. So 1 gram of radium is 1 Curie. So if a milligram emits as many as 5 grams of radium, then a gram of polonium-210 is 5,000 Curies.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, the numbers I saw for the size of polonium that is considered to be an excessive body burden is measured in the 10 to the minus 11th grams. It's a very, very tiny amount that would be ingested before it's dangerous for humans.
What column of the periodic table is polonium in? What chemical element does it behave like? Does it behave like calcium?
I know that polonium is just north of bismuth on the periodic table. It's it actually, bismuth is the source of the polonium that is used in commercial applications today, because if you expose bismuth to a neutron flux, it becomes bismuth-210. It starts off as bismuth-209, becomes bismuth-210 by absorbing a neutron, and then does a beta-minus decay to get it to polonium-210, if I remember the decay chain properly.
Curiously enough, there is also a place where you can look up the properties of the Korean Atomic Energy Organization. I believe the acronym is KAERI. They actually maintain their own version of the chart of the nucleides that you can actually go and look up nucleides on and get decay chains and branch probabilities and all that cool nuclear stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'll probably send you the link to it for the show notes.
Okay. Well, polonium-210 does have some very useful physical properties in terms of commercial utility, even though it's an extremely rare element and there's very little used in commercial applications in terms of grams, but a fair number of devices have been produced. It's used as a source in certain types of thickness detectors, and it is used in radioisotope thermal generators, particularly where there's a need for a very high power density and long lifetime, or reasonably long lifetime, because as I said, it's only about 147-day half-life.
Right. And considering that you can get 140-odd watts out of a gram of it, it's 140 watts per gram. And by comparison, a kilo of plutonium-238 in oxide form is like, what, 1,500 kilowatts for 1,000 grams? Or 1,500 watts, excuse me. So it's pretty hot. I mean, the only isotope that I know of that generates more thermal power and was actually investigated at one point was isotope of curium.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually a picture of it in Man and Atom by Glenn Seaborg that came out 35 years ago. I mentioned it before. And that particular material, when it is made and it's formed into an oxide, actually glows white hot from its activity.
Wow.
Not red, not yellow, white. And it maintains a temperature of in the thousands of Celsius degrees, all on its own. But it also has a half-life, which is very, 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 very short, something like 90-day half-life.
Interesting. Well, the some numbers that I saw that were fascinating to me was there was an interesting article that I'll put a link on it in the show notes, but it was an IEEE magazine called The Tiniest Dynamos, Tiniest Dynamos or Daintiest Dynamos or something like that.
I think I've heard of this. They're looking at the idea of using the decay energy directly, mm-hmm. rather than going through some thermal cycle in order to derive power. And the last type of battery that I've seen that had this investigated was a battery that was supposed to use nickel-28.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they paint a very small quantity. We're talking micrograms, very, very small quantities of nickel-38 onto the end of a cantilevered arm, mm-hmm. on a very small mechanism. Like, it's on the order of the sizes of a transistor that you'd see on a computer chip.
Mm-hmm.
And what it would do is, because of the fact that the nickel-28 is constantly emitting beta particles, i.e. electrons, the cantilevered arm that's painted on slowly gains a positive charge. and actually cause, well, slowly, it causes the arm to start to basically deflect away from the surface. And as it deflects, because of the material that the arm is made out of, which is piezoelectric, it actually forms a voltage. And then it gets far enough away and it springs back and basically wobbles back and forth. And the energy and the wobbling of the arm actually generates a very minute amount of power, but it's enough to run small electronic devices like single transistors and the like.
Right. It's a very interesting applications in terms of nanotechnologies and times where we're really working hard to shrink electronic devices and sensors and having micro machinery and all that, you know, exciting nano stuff. But when it comes down to what's going to power it, people kind of throw up their hands. But when they look at radioisotopes, they say, here's a possible solution. Because, for example, I saw a table in the article, and it had a list of energy densities. And, let's see, I believe that lithium ion, and I can't remember the units that these were in, so I'll forgive me for that, because I shouldn't use numbers.
Watt hours per some metric mass, like watt hours per kilogram is the usual way it goes.
Right. But. So lithium ion was 0.3. A fuel cell using methanol was 3. And a radioisotope generator using polonium-210 was 57,000. All using the same units. That's pretty amazing. So, back to the poisoned Russian former spy. He apparently accused the Kremlin on his deathbed of having poisoned him, according to some of the news articles. There are other news articles that indicate that he may have taken the polonium on his own to be able to frame the Russian government. It's a very twisted and interesting tale.
It sounds like something that would have come from the pen of Ian Fleming.
Well, you know, as soon as I read about it, it reminded me very quickly of the Ukrainian presidential race in 2004, where Yushchenko, I believe was his name, who was the sitting president and was an enemy or was opposed to Putin, was...
Or the Putin-sponsored candidate, I believe, but...
No, he was not the Putin. He was the opposition. Both of these guys had very similar names. There was Yushchenko and Yushchenko or something like that, from an American point of view. But the one who wasn't sponsored by Russia, the one who was opposed to them, suddenly developed some severe chloracne and was thought to be being poisoned by dioxin. And nearly died, but ended up surviving. So that was one of the... It immediately reminded me of that twisted tale. So this guy did die. There are people who are kind of waiting to do the autopsy while his body gets a little less radioactive.
It's the same thing that happened with the SL-1 victims. They had to actually wait a little bit before they could do the autopsy for the same reason.
Now, in this case, because of the nature of polonium, it is almost a pure alpha emitter. So it's not dangerous unless you actually ingest it. But it is so hot that if you handle it without lots of safety precautions, the chances of getting it airborne and getting it actually ingested into you is higher than most people consider to be safe. There are people, of course, that work with polonium-210, and as long as you use appropriate safety precautions, and you can even find a radioactive material safety data sheet on the web on how to handle it. It's not recommended. Now, it did surprise me. There was a lot of people that were... worried about having been in the same general vicinity as this guy, because an alpha particle doesn't go more than a couple centimeters in air.
Right, and according to And as an example, a half gram capsule, depending upon, and they're not qualifying the range, a half gram capsule throws out a gamma ray dose of, I think it, if I convert those units right, it's 1.2 rad per hour. So that's not accounting for the gamma ray spectra and how it gets absorbed in a human being. But
right, but remember, a half a gram
compared,
of
yeah.
polonium yeah. is so that's, generating that's 70 gram. Watts, right?
Yeah, that's a 70-watt source putting out something like a little over a rad an hour. And that's, to put it in comparison, in order to reach LD50, which is the dose that kills half the population that's exposed to it, you would have to sit next to this thing for 450 hours.
Yeah.
Which is just a shade under a month.
Yeah, well, but you only have to ingest about a microgram, so.
Right. A microgram, we're talking a negligible gamma dose. I mean, the gamma emitters in your body are there naturally, which swamp the signal.
Sure. So it's almost entirely alpha emitter. You want to not eat it because it can do serious damage to internal cells, because at that point it's close enough to the cell to do damage. It's not something, though, that people...
Very fast helium nucleus.
Exactly. But I do have... whenever something like this happens and the attention gets paid to it, I do have a one of those oh shit moments, because whenever bad news happens about radioactive materials, there's invariably going to be people that try to point and say, well, see, if we had more nuclear power plants, this stuff would be more readily available and terrorists could use it and we'd all be poisoned like the Russian KGB agent. But hey, if somebody wants to kill me, there's plenty of ways to do it. And
bending over backwards and doing the equivalent of buying 20 Lexuses in order to drive over a mouse is not the way to do it.
Yep.
Besides the fact that polonium-210 is not really a product or even a byproduct of a nuclear power plant unless you put bismuth into the reactor and then process the bismuth fast enough to get the polonium out before it can decay.
Yep. Well, I
have
will...
to go out of your way to make it. It's not a byproduct.
You're right. It is not a fission product. It is not something that you find in used nuclear fuel. It's not something you can produce accidentally. Now, I will say, on the other hand, that if you have a particular type of reactor, and usually power reactors are very poor at this because they're designed specifically not to allow things to be put into them, but if you had a research reactor that allows you access to the neutron flux itself, because it's designed to do that, it is possible to create plutonium-210. It's not something you worry about with power reactors. That's what is that what I said? Polonium. That's what I meant to say.
I think you said plutonium.
I meant to say polonium. Polonium. I don't even have my pop filter, so that's going to sound terrible. So, all right, let's move on. Is this one beat to a death? Yeah, this one.
I think
beaten.
We have beaten this into a red stand on the highway. Let's move on.
Okay, so we had some other things we want to talk about, but I can't remember what the heck they were.
Energy debate in Australia, the Australian version of Amory Lovins, and I've not gotten a chance to read the article, but already I'm looking forward to reading the article and making sure I don't have any soda anywhere near me to avoid spewing all over my beautiful iMac.
Well, the man is named Dr. Mark Diesendorf, and Dr. Mark Diesendorf is the director of an organization called the Sustainability Center in New South Wales, Australia. And you
I
may
can
have
hear the air quotes around it.
You may have seen an entry in the Atomic Insights blog a couple of days ago about his response that nuclear is not something that should be considered if you're worried about global warming. He has had a number of articles that he's published that say that nuclear is too dangerous, nuclear contributes to greenhouse gases throughout its fuel cycle and construction cycle and lot of, you know, et cetera.
It's a Caldicott argument, too.
Right. Well, Diesendorf's Sustainability Center is located in New South Wales. It's at the University of New South Wales. The coal industry in New South Wales is the largest source of export revenue for the state. It brings in about $5 billion a year from selling coal outside of Australia. There's also a very intensive effort by the state to develop natural gas resources, although they don't have very much right now. They want to grow the natural gas resources. And, oh, by the way, if you look at the list of clients on the Sustainability Center, it includes both a large natural gas producer and a pipeline operator.
I would imagine that most of the natural gas exploration they're looking at there is probably owing to how much coal that they have. They may be looking at coal bed gas as a form of natural gas.
There's a reason I like having you on this show. That's exactly the kind of gas we're looking at, is the coal seam methane production.
Plus, it also has the nice benefit of, if you're going to mine coal, taking the methane out of the mine prior to going in and mining the coal so as to reduce the danger seems a pretty good idea.
Well, particularly since methane in coal mines is one of the major sources of explosions, fires, cave-ins, etc., over the course of history. So it's probably not a bad idea.
Topic three, but if we wanted to finish off anything.
No, that's fine. I'm going to start really pulling the string on Mark Diesendorf and trying to engage in, I'm not, pointing any fingers. I just don't understand why someone would be very concerned about air pollution and greenhouse gases and sustainability and refuse to look at nuclear power. And when I read an article that he wrote claiming that nuclear was just way too expensive, of course he used 1998 data when comparing it to fossil fuel prices. And he ignored the fact that a large number of nuclear power plants in the U.S., although we haven't built any new ones, a lot of the plants have been sold over the past 10 years, and there is a market and an established price and a recognition by some very smart accountants that the nuclear power plants have some significant residual value, even though they've been operating for the last 30 years.
Yeah, when you insist on painting your competition as expensive based on prices from 10 years ago, that doesn't strike me as a very honest argument. But, again, I'm not going to presume to speak for him. And, by all means, if you want to, if he wants to contact us and proceed with in opening a discussion, let's have at it.
Yeah. Well, I've actually been reading an old book for the last couple of weeks. It was a book called The Demise of Light Water. And interestingly enough, this book was published in 1978, which was before Three Mile Island. And
right, just as the last of the utility plant, the first generation, were ordered in the United States.
Right. Well, by 78, the ordering had essentially stopped, like you said. You know, the peak year of orders was 1973, and after that, the orders fell off rather dramatically. But anyway, The Demise of Light Water had a very interesting discussion about how a lot of the anti-nuclear organizations worked very hard to delay plants, to make them make changes that added significant costs, that required them to, whenever there was a new regulation. They had to apply it to all the old plants, and they worked very hard at that. And then after doing that for several years, they turned around and started using the arguments, well, of course, nuclear power is just too expensive to compete in the marketplace. So interesting contrast there, and a recognition.
If you put up enough layers of cardboard arguments, eventually you can stop bullets.
Right. And that leads me to my discussion about the economic comparisons between nuclear generating costs and coal generating costs. Because one of the things that just kind of frosts my goat, or gets me a little bit upset, gets my goat, frosts my cake, whatever you want to say, is the fact that the coal industry fights even minor safety and cleanliness and pollution limitations. I mean, I drive by a coal-fired power plant every day on the way to work. And along the highway that I drive is a set of railroad tracks that brings coal cars to the plant. And all of those railroad cars are open cars. So they drive the coal from West Virginia to suburban Maryland near Washington, D.C. in open coal cars. They can't even be bothered to put a cover on top of these cars, which means along the way they're spreading their dust for everybody who lives near the tracks.
Nice.
It's just amazing to me that, I mean, that's just, it would seem so easy to cover that car rather than leave it open.
Well, when you got a billion short tons to shift around the country every year, which is the current consumption rate for coal in the United States, we consume 8 billion metric tons, plus or minus, according to what I've found off of the Energy Information Administration site. And I suppose they could say that they have so much to ship that, and that the form of the coal is in largely in the rock form as it comes out of the ground, and there's not very much dust. But those, given how much money that they make, especially that the cost of coal is increasing, there's another really interesting point is that coal plants, I learned recently, are all held to the same sulfur dioxide emission standards. They're not allowed to adjust their sulfur dioxide emissions for how much sulfur there is in the coal. So Western coal is held to the same sulfur dioxide limitations as Eastern coal, so it's kind of, it flattens the playing field a little bit, and that's just something I learned recently.
That effect that had was that when the sulfur dioxide standards were imposed, coal plants that did not have sulfur dioxide emissions controls installed often found it cheaper to bring coal in from a much longer distance and burn the low sulfur Western coals than to add sulfur dioxide controls to the plant itself. So they met their emissions requirements simply by burning lower sulfur coal.
Right.
And the lower sulfur coal, as it turns out, not only was coming from further away, but it has a lower energy value per unit mass. So it was coal that didn't have as a good a market before the sulfur dioxide emissions standards were imposed. So it was a real boon to Wyoming coal, for example.
I think I actually went and found the Powder River Basin in Wyoming in Google Earth one time, and it's phenomenal how large it is, even from many kilometers viewing altitude to look down on this rather dark terrain that is being strip mined on a scale which would make building the pyramids look like a kid playing in a sandbox.
Well, I'll tell you, the vehicles that are used in those strip mines are some of the most impressive engineering marvels that I've ever seen. I mean, if you stand next to one of the trucks that's carrying coal at the coal mines, you know, to the trains, your head would only be at the first layer of the tire. In other
your
words,
head just comes up to the rim.
Right, comes up to the rim, and then there's the rest of the rim, and then there's the rest of the tire. I mean, it's that tall. It's incredible, and the devices that's used to dig the coal out of the ground is also incredible, because in Wyoming, in the Powder River Basin, the coal seams in some cases are 60 to 100 feet thick, which from the point of view of eastern coal miners, where they used to send guys in the mine to pull out seams that were a couple of feet thick, is pretty incredible.
I remember seeing it was a program about the largest engineering machines used in any engineering works in the world, and it was a crane that they used. I believe it was at Powder River and some of the other really big strip mining operations. And the crane is so heavy that it actually doesn't have wheels; it has feet. Hmm. Only the feet are about half the size of a football field.
Wow!
It slowly picks them up and moves them, and it moves at a rate that the space shuttle carrying crawler that they use to transport the space shuttle from the vehicle assembly building out to launch pad would make seem like a sprinter.
Hmm. Yeah, one of the, I guess I just made an entry in my blog because there was a great article in the Pine magazine about mountaintop removal. Just, to me, a really tough thing to accept, because I love going to the mountains and Virginia and West Virginia and doing things like whitewater rafting or hiking along the Appalachian Trail and thinking about people just blowing off the top of the mountain so they could get to the coal seam is a little bit disconcerting.
That's putting it somewhat mildly.
Yeah.
I've seen many, many, many articles about the kinds of situations that people in that part of the world are in. And number one, that's the number one employer.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, these people happen to be very, very close to the land. They love where they live, and they wouldn't leave it for anything. But there are people who are waking up and finding that their view out their backyard now looks on a pile of overburden that's been dumped into the valley that's cut off the stream. And it's basically turned mountain and valley into so many mesas. And mesas are fine in New Mexico, but I don't think they're expecting mesas in Kentucky, West Virginia.
Well, of course, one of the other issues with mountaintop removal is that the reason it's being used is a, quote, modern, high-tech, capital-intensive way to mine, which isn't particularly labor-intensive. In other words, a lot of the jobs that used to be associated with mining a certain amount of coal are no longer in existence, because the productivity per miner of the coal industry has gone up so much because of using techniques like blasting off the top of the mountain and digging it out with a great big shovel.
We're a long ways from 16 tons a day.
Yes, we are. And I'm not necessarily advocating that you know, people shouldn't use higher productivity methods if they're safe and effective and good for the environment. But the idea that, you know, knocking the top of a mountain off and taking a forest and turning it into a meadow is good is kind of absurd to me. But anyway.
And of course, as we've talked about before, uranium mining has its own high productivity methods that do not involve mountaintop removal, namely using oxygen and soda water to derive uranium ore out of the ground and do essentially no damage, doesn't even cause the landscape to sag all that much.
Right. Well, because you're not taking very much out. I mean,
right. You're only taking exactly the uranium. You're leaving the stuff that the uranium is dissolved in behind to keep holding the land up so the land doesn't move.
Right, and because uranium is so energy dense, there's not a tremendous amount of uranium that needs to be removed in comparison to a billion tons of coal, which is really moving a billion tons of rock from one place to another and burning part of it off. Yeah.
And then figuring out what to do with the less than billion tons of fly ash and something like 4 billion tons of carbon dioxide and however many millions of tons of all the other pleasant gases that come out of a coal-fired power plant.
Yep.
And well, a billion tons, if you apply the conversion, is something like, let's see, a billion divided by 2.6 million. We're going to lop a few orders of magnitude off that number.
Right. And when it comes to it, you know, we do burn a billion tons of coal a year. The coal industry is relatively profitable. However, on the big scheme of things, it really isn't that big an industry because the average price of coal in the U.S. is somewhere around $40 or $50 a ton. So you're talking about all of the devastation that we're discussing for an industry that produces about $50 billion a year in revenue, which isn't terribly significant.
No.
On the scale of our economy.
General aviation as a transportation sector is responsible for $150 billion a year in revenue.
Wow.
So right there, and general aviation is for all intents and purposes invisible on the scale of the really large things in the economy.
Yeah, we'll see.
As one of my mentors put it, or I might paraphrase one of my mentors and say that coal power is a lot of chopping and a lot of chips flying, but the tree ain't coming down.
Yep. Well, one of the things that I like to respond when people talk about nuclear power is going to, you know, destroy coal jobs or something is, again, pointing back to the fact that there aren't that many jobs left in the coal industry. It's a fairly capital-intensive industry. And nuclear power, on the other hand, it takes a lot of people to run a power plant, and there's an awful lot of jobs that those skilled coal miners could do very well within the nuclear industry, because one of the things we're really going to need is skilled technicians and people who are willing to follow procedures and do things correctly and that kind of stuff. So I think
given how incredibly dangerous it is to work in a coal mine and how much that they have to pay attention to training with the equipment, they can train to those same levels with nuclear systems and not have to worry about being replaced. And what's happening in the coal industry is what happened over the latter part of the last century with farming. And now any farmer in the United States supports something like 100 to 120 people per person.
Right.
Farmers only make up less than 1% of the population, but they feed the entire country plus mm-hmm. a lot of other people besides.
Yep.
And coal is on that same order because they're dealing with a product which doesn't cost very much and that they have to produce an enormous amount of in order to make revenue.
Exactly. Well, I think that you and I agree that I would much prefer to see new nuclear plants over new coal plants. And, in fact, one of the things that I want to see is as we build new nuclear plants and we start getting to a point where people might be worried about overcapacity is to begin shutting down coal plants, actually yep. taking away some of their market share. And I know that is one of the reasons why people have fought against nuclear power so much is because that's the threat, that nuclear power is going to come in and remove markets from those fossil fuel plants. But, hey, that's the breaks of the competitive game.
And there's always room for people who can make that kind of money in an industry where your total revenue is only $50 billion a year. There's a lot of room for those people and their instincts elsewhere.
Oh, sure. Well, there's plenty of room. So, anyway, I think that we beat these things to death, and we'll move on and talk to you all next week. We hope to bring you a few more interviews. Maybe talk about some thorium power systems. I'm also working to try to get a couple of people who are opposed to nuclear energy to come on board the show and just try to explain to us why they feel so strongly that nuclear is not the way to go, despite all evidence to the contrary.
Great.
Yep. All right. And that was show number 39.
In the can.
Hey, it's Wayne Trammell, host of the Cranky Middle Manager Show. And if you can pull yourself away from the donuts in the break room long enough to listen, I'd sure appreciate it. The Cranky Middle Manager Show on Podcast Network. We have interviews, the classic quote of the week, and, of course, the most honest take on the life of those of us who toil in the honest, hard-working world of middle management. That's the Cranky Middle Manager Show on the Podcast Network. I haven't had this much fun since I found out 360-degree feedback really was anonymous.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.